Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services, February 19th. And we have moved the agenda around a little bit. We're going to hear Senate Bill 420. Then we're going to have our informational meeting, which will take, the informational meeting will take about 40 minutes, 45 minutes. And then we will hear Senate Bill 132. So for those of you that don't want to hear the first bill and the informational hearing, you can certainly wait out in the hall. You don't need to stay in. So with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 132.
No.
I mean 420.
Thank you.
And Senator Dingfelder, and I don't have the list of the other speakers, but that will come. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and member of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon, and thank you for letting us go first, because we will be very efficient. My name is Senator Jackie Dingfelder, and I represent parts of Northeast and Southeast Portland and Maywood Park around the northern part of the state. I'm here to share support for a bill in front of you, Senate Bill 420, and I have some folks who are going to share their stories with you here in just a little bit. According to the Center for Disease Control, breast cancer is a leading cause of cancer-related deaths among women, killing over 40,000 women in the U.S. in 2009, which is the latest statistics that we have. The good news is with the use of mammography, we're able to catch cancer earlier and when it's more treatable. However, mammography is less effective at catching cancer in women with dense breast tissue. Dense breast tissue is comprised of less fatty tissue and more glandular tissue. What this means is that on a mammogram, and you do have handouts in front of you with a visual so you can see that, dense breast tissue appears as white, the same color as tumors, making it very difficult to see early stage cancers. In fact, mammograms typically miss 40% or more of tumors in women with dense breasts. Welcome, rest of committee members.
Thank you. Apologize.
In addition to masking cancers, dense breast tissue is an independent risk factor and can be a greater risk factor than having two first-degree relatives with breast cancer. Yet very few women know the risks associated with dense breast tissue, let alone their own dense breasty. Breast density, and that was something that I learned recently when I was called back after a mammogram, and I had no idea that I actually did have a dense breast tissue as well. Senate Bill 420 seeks to raise awareness and educate women about dense breast tissue, and this bill would require a healthcare facility or radiologist who performs a mammogram noting dense breast tissue to issue a notice to the patient educating them about the dense breast tissue and risks associated with this issue. This would allow women to better understand the risks that they face of getting breast cancer and to understand the limits of mammography. It will also prevent more stories like the ones that you will hear in a moment from the ladies on either side of me. And also, you will hear that they did everything that they could, yet the doctor still missed cancer for 2 years. Both state and federal standards require comprehensive coverage of mammograms to ensure women have access to affordable breast cancer screening. However, for the 40% of women with dense breast tissue, mammography is less effective. While mammography is the most widely available screening test for breast cancer today, and while it does save lives, it is important to recognize that mammography has major limitations, especially for women with dense breast tissue. In addition to ensuring women understand their breast density, Senate Bill 420 will also require insurance coverage of breast ultrasounds if a woman has had a mammogram and a doctor determines that she has dense breast tissue and recommends another screening procedure. If mammography is to be used as a base-level screening procedure and therefore a covered procedure, we must consider the fact that mammography does not always work for a significant part of the population. We must also make affordable screening alternatives available. So I urge your support for Senate Bill 420, as it will save lives by educating women about the risks of dense breast tissue, make them aware of alternatives to mammography, and require women with dense breast tissue that they have access to affordable screening alternatives. By passing this bill, we will increase early detection of breast cancer and improve survival rates and ultimately save lives. You're going to hear firsthand from these women. I do want to mention that we did receive a fiscal on this from the Oregon Health Authority because of the impact for the Oregon Health Plan and the folks that we cover, and certainly we are interested in having discussions with the committee about that because obviously there is a cost involved. But I think it's really important at a minimum to have the education component of this bill to educate women. With that, I'd like to have our guests tell their stories, and then I will stay and see if there's any questions.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. We have till 3:25 before we move to the next agenda.
I only have one other person that
That'd be great.
With us to sign up.
And I have it's Lynn Sweeney, Lynn Sweeney and Laura Caldwell.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you for allowing me to share. I am. My name is Laura Caldwell, and I live in Eugene. And I'm very honored to share my story in support of this bill. I am the mother of three children, and I've been happily married for 26 years. In August of 2011, I had my annual mammogram, as I've had for the previous 6 years. The mammogram came back clear and fine. I don't have breast cancer in my family, so it's a test that I was never worried about. And I do a lot to help reduce my risk factors, so I was not worried about the test. A month later, after several days of pain under my arm, I went to see my doctor. Noting that I had a clear mammogram, she put me on a course of antibiotics and asked me to return should the pain continue. 10 days later, and still referring to my clear mammogram, she sent me for a diagnostic mammogram just to be safe. A diagnostic mammogram is just a fancy word for an ultrasound. My ultrasound revealed a lump, and a biopsy confirmed invasive ductal carcinoma that had spread to my lymph nodes. When the diagnosing doctor called to tell me the news, just 8 weeks now from my normal mammogram, I asked him why the mammogram hadn't caught my tumor. He said it was because I had what was called dense breast tissue, and that the tumors just don't show up as easily on mammograms of women with dense tissue. In fact, he said he was looking at my now 8-week-old mammogram, and he still couldn't see the tumor on the scan, even though pathology confirmed the cancer diagnosis. When I questioned the doctor further, I said, "No one has ever told me I have dense breast tissue." And he replied, and I will quote him, "We don't usually tell women that information." I would find out later that my tumor was 2 years old by the time that we discovered it. It could have gone undetected even longer had I not developed those symptoms. And in essence, I probably had 2 to 3 clear mammograms, all while living with a growing cancer. Despite the fact that 40% of women have dense breast tissue and women with it are 4 to 6 times more likely to develop breast cancer, fewer than 10% of women with dense tissue are informed about it by their doctors. And as you can see from my story, I only found out about my dense tissue and ultimately my cancer from that additional screening. Having dense breast tissue is a risk factor. There's no history of breast cancer in my family, but breast density is a more significant risk factor for developing breast cancer than having a first-degree relative with it. My work as a consultant and trainer with the Pampered Chef puts me in front of hundreds of women every year. I have discovered as I have shared my story with them that the majority of women have never heard the term dense breast tissue, let alone if they have it and that it's a risk factor. We all know that early detection is the best possible way to treat breast cancer, but women are not hearing about their breast density from their doctor, and that makes it harder to catch these cancers early. I cannot help but think that had I known about my tissue density, early detection would have prevented it from spreading. My cancer, as with all cancers, show up as white on a mammogram. Unfortunately, dense tissue also shows up as white. Women should be receiving the information in their doctor's offices, not after they find out they have cancer. I've also encountered women that have discovered that they have dense breast tissue, many with a history of cancer in their family, that have had to fight with their doctors and insurance companies to get the necessary screenings. I am thankful that this bill would guarantee women the ability to get those additional screenings. My cancer diagnosis classified my cancer at stage 3. My cancer was not detected early because of the failure of mammography technology to detect the cancer in my dense tissue. I'm encouraged by this bill that would notify more women earlier and to provide additional screenings to those women that need it. Oregon has one of the highest rates of breast cancer in the country, but it has one of the lowest death rates. A shift could happen dramatically in either direction depending upon the passage of this bill. In 2012, I completed 4 months of chemotherapy, a bilateral mastectomy, with lymphectomy, and 7 weeks of daily radiation. I went into remission last March. Unfortunately, this last Friday, the doctors have found a new tumor, this time on my brain. They believe it is most likely the breast cancer that has moved through my lymph system and settled in my brain. I will have it removed 1 week from today. There are only 5 states in this country that require doctors to tell women about their breast density, and only 2 of them that include the insurance portion. I implore you today to make Oregon the 6th state. Please move this bill along and pass it. It is important to my daughter, who will probably inherit dense breast tissue, to my future grandchildren. It is important to the state as a whole, to women and to men and to children and to the future generations of our state. You will be saving many lives with this bill. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for coming and sharing your story. Humanizing policy work really makes a big difference in the decisions that we make.
Thank you.
So thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chairman Moniz Anderson and the rest of the committee. My name is Lynn Sweeney, and I live in Southeast Portland. I myself have not suffered from cancer, but Laura is my sister-in-law. This bill is very important to me because she's being treated for cancer currently that began in her dense breast tissue. She was unaware she had dense breast until her diagnosis. I'm so torn up that she's going through this, and I don't want to lose her. I feel so helpless because there's nothing I can do directly to affect her health. She's so dear to our family. The only way I can help is to urge you to move forward with this bill. Then maybe other women will have their cancer detected during routine testing. My sister-in-law didn't get that chance, and I hate to say this, especially with her in the room, she might die because of it. Here are some facts about dense breast tissue and cancer. Breast density is a well-established predictor of breast cancer. In dense breasts, mammograms miss half of the cancers. 40% of women have dense breast tissue. Adding other tests, such as ultrasound, can increase detection by up to 100%. Therefore, knowing if you have dense breasts is vital to making informed decisions about your health. Now, there's no requirement to even tell women or to provide an ultrasound. Here's another sobering fact. 95% of women do not know their breast density. I'm very surprised healthcare providers don't routinely provide this information to women. Is it because they fear increased cost of testing? Or perhaps they just don't think women need to know? Either reason is indefensible. I strongly urge you to move this bill forward. Oregon women need this. In closing, I would ask you ladies, do you know if you have dense breast tissue? Gentlemen, do your significant others know if they are dense? Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming. Yes, Dr. Steiner, you're right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to start getting all choked up about this one. I'm very proud to be co-chief sponsor of this with Senator Dingfelder. And I apologize for coming in late. I was dealing with a couple other things. But I spent the past 10 years of my career as a physician at OHSU working on improving early detection of breast cancer, primarily in my case through clinical breast exam, because often in women with dense breast tissue, a really high-quality clinical breast exam can help a lot to find breast cancer early, because even in dense breast tissue, cancer feels different than normal tissue, or can feel different. no one should have to go through what you and your family are going through. And the more we can do to prevent that, the better. And the more that we can empower women and men by educating them about breast density and how it can affect both cancer risk and the effectiveness of mammography as a screening tool, the better. We want to be in partnership with our patients, and that means educating them. I would like to take the liberty of clarifying one thing you said, if I may.
Yeah.
The reason that this bill is so important to me is that a diagnostic mammogram is very different from a screening mammogram. And what that means is that in a screening mammogram, for everybody in the room who's ever had one, and for those of you who haven't, is generally two views of each breast. The radiologists take pictures from two different directions of the breast. A diagnostic mammogram, and a screening mammogram is covered 100% under Oregon law and under the Federal Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
Screening tests for certain common diseases are completely covered. But a diagnostic mammogram is when we suspect something's wrong and we have a concern. A woman has a mass, there's something else concerning on the screening mammogram, and at which point they go in and take a lot more different pictures with the mammogram machine, not just with the ultrasound. And diagnostic testing is not covered 100% under the Affordable Care Act or under Oregon law. And we run into a challenge there because as soon as we convert from a screening mammogram to a diagnostic mammogram in a woman with dense breast tissue, if there's anything of concern, then it's not covered 100%.
Mm.
Leaving ultrasound completely aside for the moment, just getting the additional views changes it to a diagnostic mammogram, and that's where we run into trouble. So empowering women by educating them and finding a way to parse that difference in women with dense breast tissue where we just aren't getting enough of a look to figure out a way to make it affordable for women to get that additional testing but still keep it as a screening test is where we need to be moving to prevent stories like yours.
Thank you.
So thank you all very, very much. Thank you, Senator Dingfelder, for including me on this. And I look forward to continuing to move this bill forward as fast as we can.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And, Laura, is that your daughter and husband?
Yes.
Yes. Welcome. And we, our prayers and thoughts
Thank
are
you.
Sending positive energy
Thank
your
you.
Way
Thank
for
you.
Next week.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thomas Bruner.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Thomas Bruner. I'm the CEO of Susan G. Komen for the Cure in Oregon and Southwest Washington. And I'm here to lend our support for Senate Bill 420. And I guess to be quite honest with you, all I can really say is wow. It is unconscionable to us that after 30 years of fighting like hell to educate women about breast cancer, to educate the medical community and healthcare providers about breast cancer, that we've come so far to only have so much farther to go. The fact that most women know nothing about density, nothing about its complicating factor in screening, is unconscionable to us at Komen. We are wholeheartedly in support of any and all efforts to continue to educate women about breast cancer, including breast density and the role that density might play as a risk factor or in complicating screening or diagnostics. And whether it's screening or whether it's diagnostic, let's be clear, whatever it takes to find it is the right thing to do. And we encourage you to make sure that Oregon is a state that doesn't say no to a woman whose life could possibly be saved. So cover it. Thank you so much for having us.
And Sandy, I think that we will need information on the costs of the screening test versus the costs of the diagnostic tests. We will need to have a fiscal to see the impact it has on OWEB and PEB to see if it's a ways and means referral or not. And so that's the type of information that we will need before we go forward.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I know you have a lot of people behind you that like to testify on another bill. We really appreciate you putting this as a priority and look forward to further discussions and hope that we can work together to move this bill forward.
Great. Thank you so very, very much. All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 420 and open an informational meeting on health systems transformation and CCO quality and accountability metrics. Bruce Goldberg and Tina Edlund.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, the director of the Oregon Health Authority. We're here today to talk to you about quality in our CCOs, and actually it's a appropriate segue from the previous bill and testimony, because certainly assuring quality and the best possible services in our healthcare system is a goal for all of us. We're here today to talk specifically about the metrics and quality measures in our coordinated care organizations. We have with the federal government an agreement. It's our accountability plan that really addresses the conditions around which we were able to get our waiver request, as well as the $1.9 billion of federal support for our transformation from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. And what this accountability plan does is describe what we as a state are accountable for, focusing on really two pieces. One, what the CCOs need to report to the state, and then secondly, what the state needs to report to CMS. And this plan was approved back in December. And just to remind everybody on the committee, what we as a state committed to CMS about was to reduce the annual increase in the cost of care by 2 percentage points. That's lowering the cost of bending the cost curve, ensuring that quality of care improves, and ensuring that the population health improves, and establishing a 1% withhold. We
I can't get the slide up.
Okay. And establishing a quality pool. It's really that quality pool that we're here today to talk about. The elements of that. Oh, great.
We'll get it.
There we go.
Right there.
The elements of our approach to quality in the CCOs are really twofold. One is there's a series of quality assurance activities, which quite frankly are really no different than were a part of our waiver with the feds to do Medicaid managed care, as well as the kinds of guidelines that the federal government has with all states. That's really a series of on-site reviews, quarterly and annual financial reporting, complaints, grievance, and appeal reporting, fraud and abuse reporting. The second piece is really what's new, and that's our quality improvement strategy, which really revolves around four things. One is some performance improvement projects that CCOs need to engage in, the transformation plans by which CCOs really lay out their plans for improving quality and delivery of care, transparency of what we do, and then lastly, what we're here today to talk about, which is the financial metrics. We also provide support for the CCOs to move through this by setting up a transformation center, opportunities for learning collaboratives, peer-to-peer and rapid cycle learning, community advisory councils, non-traditional healthcare workers, and primary care home adoption. So that really sets the context to our quality strategy. Now I'm going to turn things over to...
Sorry. Could you go back to that last slide for one moment, please, Ms. Edlin? Thank you. Dr. Goldberg, could you talk a little bit about the peer-to-peer and rapid cycle learning systems piece? I'm always interested in thinking about how do we expand medical education and actually get... We had this conversation about the evidence-based medicine thing last week about how do you actually get new information out in ways that are incorporated quickly by healthcare professionals?
So
I'll have to interrupt.
Okay.
Our focus is on the metrics, and
okay.
we really don't have time to go into this, but this is a
answer
great thing
that offline.
We...
Okay, that'd be great.
Okay.
Another time. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
So I'm going to turn things over to Tina Edlund, who's going to walk us through the metrics.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tina Edlund. I'm the Chief of Policy for the Oregon Health Authority. So the metrics really came out of our negotiations, the waiver negotiations with CMS. They felt quite strongly that they didn't want our guarantee of expenditure reduction to happen at the cost of quality and access. So these metrics became a very important focal point of our negotiations with CMS. So the state, there's two levels of the relationship with CMS. There's the state to CMS, and then there's the state to the CCOs. And we have accountability on both sides. The state's accountable to CMS for a set of 33 metrics. A subset of that 33, 17, are the CCO metrics that they're accountable for. The 33 metrics are grouped into seven focus areas that were identified in collaboration between CMS and the state. They're areas where we have identified either issues, quality issues in the past, or areas where we really just were identified in transformation as areas that we wanted to focus on in the transformation. So the 17 metrics came out of the Metrics and Scoring Committee. That's a committee that was established by the legislature to choose metrics for CCOs to hold CCOs accountable. There are 9 members on the committee. 3 members are at large, 3 with expertise in health outcomes measurement, and 3 representatives of CCOs. So they used the public process. There were public meetings. They developed a set of criteria for choosing the metrics and landed on 17 that then were forwarded on to CMS for review and approval. CMS actually only changed 3 things, and they were very slight. They thought we had duplicate measures for mental health in adults and wanted a pediatric mental health measure added. So that's just one example of the 3 items they actually changed. The data collection strategy, one of the principles of the Metrics and Scoring Committee, was that we make data collection as simple for the CCOs as possible. We use national standards. We try to use administrative data where possible, even though, you know, everyone will agree that administrative data isn't always the best as reflecting quality. It's data we have, and it's data that's easy to get. So it comes from administrative or billing data that's already submitted to the state. For measures that require chart review, the OHA has agreed to actually conduct the chart review for CCOs. So there's really minimal kinds of effort on the part of CCOs. There is some interest, I will say, from CCOs that have called to say those measures that require chart review can oftentimes be, we can get them from EHR, from electronic health records, and they do want to work with us on identifying the best ways to get that so that we're not burdened by chart review. So these 17 metrics all are part of the financial incentive plan that's also included in the waiver.
Just a quick question on this. Will each CCO have their own data collection system that can talk? I mean, will everyone be able to talk to each other?
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that you're referring to health information exchange.
Yes.
And, you know, that is the
that's
goal
different.
Over the long run, and that is different, although... although you're right, I mean, these metrics ultimately should all be able, we should be able to deliver them through health information exchange, and that is a long-range goal.
Okay.
So the quality pool, CMS sees this as sort of a bridge strategy from the way we pay now, which is on this capitation basis to CCOs, to one that's increasingly paid where you pay for outcomes. And this is the beginning. Having this set of incentives is the beginning of starting to pay for outcomes. The goal outlined in the waiver is that the size of this pool will increase as a proportion of the global budgets that CCOs live within every year of the waiver. So every year of the four remaining years of the waiver. The first year, it's going to be 2% of the total PMPM that's in the global budgets that a CCO can be eligible for by meeting metric standards. So there's, again, 17 metrics that land in the seven focus areas. These, I won't go through every single measure here, but I did want to point out that they do fall into these seven focus areas. We really spent a lot of time trying to make sure that we had metrics in each of these areas. Behavioral health, addressing underlying cost drivers was a really a focused area of the committee. As you can see, there are five of the metrics that land in that area. Maternal and child health metrics, that reflects the large proportion of women. Medicaid is a program for women and children. Over half of the births in the state are paid for by Medicaid. So having metrics that really address prenatal care delivery and screening of young children became really an important factor for the committee. Metrics that address chronic conditions. We all have heard the 80-20 rule that 80% of the costs are driven by 20% of the population, people with multiple chronic conditions.
Yes,
so there are three
items
there.
Senator
Steiner-Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought that making sure that women who didn't want to become pregnant were getting effective contraception was going to be one of the metrics around maternal and child health, or did that end up somewhere else, or did it get dropped?
It didn't. No, it's not dropped. It actually is a metric we're collecting. It's not part of this incentive pool, and it's not part of the
okay.
CCO accountability. But no, we are measuring that and reporting it at the state level.
Because clearly, prevention of unplanned pregnancies is a very important thing to be doing.
I would agree. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
No, it wasn't dropped. Metrics addressing chronic conditions, I touched on that. Metrics to ensure appropriate access in emergency department care, this was one of the items that CMS changed. We originally just wanted an absolute reduction in emergency department utilization. They wanted to make sure that we weren't doing that just by making it impossible to get into the ED, but also that we were at the same time increasing access to ambulatory care, to care in the provider setting.
Remind me again what PCPCH is.
Yeah, I was just going to say. The rate of PCPCH enrollment, that is patient-centered primary care homes. I apologize for not having that spelled out on the slide. And then access to care. These are done through surveys, again, surveys that the agency OHA will be administering. The consumer assessment of health plan survey is a really classic tool that's used to measure client satisfaction. And then the final one, electronic health record adoption and meaningful use. This was a very important one to CMS as well, that we are pushing the statewide spread of electronic health records.
Madam Chair, so to a large degree, we're still counting widgets.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, yes, to a certain extent, we are in this middle ground, I think, where we're trying to develop a system where we just are outcomes driven, but we're still in this old, have one foot in the old world at the same time while we move to an outcomes-based world.
But I'm assuming, if I could, that CMS likes people to count widgets.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, members of the committee, I think the committee struggled with the same thing CMS is struggling with. I actually think CMS would like to move to really looking at outcomes rather than counting widgets. I think the problem is a technical one, that it's the struggle between flexibility and accountability. We don't have really good measures in place that measure something other than the counting of the widgets, and so there's a fear to moving towards this sort of new environment, and we're doing it a step at a time.
Because you go from widgets to, you're making value judgments if you go beyond widgets, basically, you know.
I don't think I quite understand. We may want to, Hayward. I don't understand what you're saying by widgets, Senator Cruz, but when I look at things such as optimal diabetes care and controlling hypertension, I mean, those aren't actual endpoint options. I mean, I'd really like to know how many people are having, diabetic nephropathy, kidney damage from their diabetes, or how many people are having heart attacks or strokes from their high blood pressure. These are intermediate outcomes, but they're still patient-centered outcomes. They're not widgets. And all of the maternal, I don't quite know what adolescent well care visits really are, so whether that's really a patient-centered outcome, but it probably is, just making sure it happens. So I guess I need to understand a little bit more about what you mean by counting widgets. Senator Cruz?
Okay, let's go back to the slide for the diabetes and there. Okay, optimal diabetes care. You would probably measure that, I'm assuming, by looking historically at the events that have happened, and if you're doing good care, those events aren't happening. So, to a degree, am I off base on this? I mean, I think that if you're going to improve the diabetes care, you aren't going to have so many severe incidents and things like that. So it's still kind of, you're counting things that happen or don't happen.
Oh, okay.
So Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, the optimal diabetes care is actually a count of control of your hemoglobin A1C. So it's the control of your blood sugar levels. It's rather than events happening, is are you in control?
Okay. So it's what we describe as an intermediate outcome. There's reasonably good evidence to suggest, if I may, Dr. Goldberg, there's reasonably good evidence to suggest that if we do a good job of controlling someone's blood sugar in the short, medium, and long term, that we can prevent the end-stage complications from diabetes. So when you're looking in the very short term, but it takes years for those to develop, so using blood sugar control as an intermediate measure in these first few years of CCOs as a way of figuring out whether we're doing a good job of helping people keep their diabetes under control, in theory, should translate to fewer adverse effects, long-term complications from the diabetes down the road, which will in turn improve health and reduce cost.
But in the short term, we're still counting widgets.
I think it's inevitable and unavoidable, frankly.
I think all of us have agreed going into this that one of the biggest challenges of all of this transformation is coming up with new and different ways of measuring quality,
right.
And that's
right.
Not unique to CCOs. It's really a part of our entire healthcare system, and I think we're seen by CMS as well as others around the country as getting out ahead and beginning to develop some different things. And this is just the start of what's going to be a process that will likely change over the next several years.
Okay, to continue with the quality pool. I wanted to talk very briefly about how the quality pool will work. Again, as I said, it's the first year, it's 2% of the total PMPM in a global budget. So all the money in the pool is distributed in every year. The potential pool award is really determined by your plan size, with a minimum amount established as a floor that you would be eligible for as a CCO, to really account for the fact that a small CCO has somewhat the same burdens in data collection and responsibility as a large CCO does. CCOs can access the dollars by either meeting performance targets or improvement targets. So they can, either way, if you meet a benchmark, you're eligible for the pool, or if you improve by a certain amount that the committee has established.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'm puzzled. I'm trying to do some arithmetic in my head. If you go back 2% per member per month for every CCO, and you have a CCO that doesn't meet benchmarks or target improvements, or maybe they only meet them in 12 of the 17 metrics, then in theory they wouldn't get all of the 2% back. Does that mean that some CCOs might get more than the 2% back? And if so, Is it because they're doing even a better job than the baseline?
Mm-hmm.
Or the expectation for meeting those 17 metrics? Could you just clarify that a little bit, please?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, absolutely. That is what happens. In the first round, not all of the money would be allocated. So rather, the committee, rather than try to assume a weighting system for the metrics where each metric may be weighted a different amount and require some value judgment, what they decided was to take the dollars that aren't allocated at the end of the first round for CCOs that don't meet all of the targets and create what they call the challenge pool. And what they put in the challenge pool was four metrics that they really felt were more transformative, that really were moving us in the direction that we wanted to move in transformation. So it is enrollment in patient-centered primary care homes, screening for depression with a follow-up plan, substance abuse screening, and then the optimal diabetes care. At that point in the second round, all of the dollars are awarded out of that pool.
All right. Thank you.
So it's basically a weighting system.
Okay, that's helpful. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
The final item that there's obviously a lot of conversation about is this. The state also agreed with USDOJ as part of an agreement to monitor the utilization of community mental health services in the state. There are around 111 metrics that USDOJ is holding the state accountable for as part of that agreement. Of that 111, the state, we really do view this, the agency views this as a state responsibility. We've identified methods to collect 101 of those 111. There are only 10 remaining elements that need to come from the CCOs. We think the reporting burden is very minimal. It's things that we can't get at from the agency. It's number of subcontracts for some crisis services. So do you have a crisis call line? And how many, if you do, how many contracts do you have? And then how many calls do you receive on that crisis line? So there are there are 10 of those. The first reporting for USDOJ is due April 2013, so you can imagine we're working furiously to get that done. But as I said, we worked very hard to minimize the burden on CCOs for this agreement.
So this is in lieu of the lawsuit that was pending. So I would also point out, it also points out the need for us to be focused on community-based mental health.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, members of the committee, you're absolutely right. And I think it also was pretty clear in our discussions with the Department of Justice that we can all say what we want about our mental health system. We didn't have a lot of good information around to base what were opinions and judgments. And I think what this really, what the settlement with the Department of Justice represented was, I think they understood that our investment in CCOs and in healthcare transformation was going to, they believe, help improve our mental health care system, and that we needed to invest in that and go forward with this process. What they really wanted was some assurance that it was working, hence the metrics and the ability to measure our performance as we go forward.
Madam Chair, I just say there's a lot of stuff comes from the feds that bothers me, but I would suggest that the Department of Justice focus on community-based mental health, I think, is good. It's forcing us to do what we should be doing anyway.
No argument.
But I'm still surprised that they are micromanaging this to such an extent. 111 metrics is huge.
It's lawyers.
But CMS is only requiring 30.
I know, exactly.
And DOJ is requiring 111.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, this agreement was worked out over a long time, and I think we
by lawyers.
By definition, yeah. That's correct.
Yeah, this was on our plate a couple of years ago. We knew this was coming. We needed to either respond or we were in deep trouble. So
I think we've tried to look at this in a positive manner.
Yeah, I applaud the response.
That it actually was in many ways a historic agreement for the Department of Justice to really say that they believed in what we were doing. They now wanted some assurance in monitoring that. We spent a lot of time, although I would say the number is great, we did pay attention to the burden of data collection, and that looking at each of those, and I can give all of you the agreement, and you can really see it makes a lot of sense, and it will help us really gauge the investments that Senator Cruz is talking about and help us make certain the dollars go to the best care. So we really feel good about it.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Bruce, when do we start when we have the new metrics in place, what's the turn-on date?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Shields, the data starts, the base year for data collection is 13. So we started collecting data January 1st of 2013. We hope to have the first data, the first metrics reported publicly sometime in late summer. Some of them will come later. The survey-based metrics obviously come after the survey is out in the field. But that it should start in the late summer.
So follow up. So we'll collect them, and then we start seeing how we're doing on all these measures beginning.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, it's about the same time as when we first can actually, a lot of these metrics actually require a year's worth of data, some 6 months worth of data in order to actually produce the metrics. So I'm thinking the first metrics will be available in late summer.
Okay, and then
this
we,
year.
Then
we and then we, and then quarter. We can, and then okay. Every quarter we will hopefully roll them, you know, drop a quarter off and add a quarter on, so you always have a year's worth of data, and that is when the monitoring starts. Then the quality pool payout, the assessment would probably be June of 14 would be the first payout from the quality pool because of the lag in claims and the lag in data.
And then
something we'd like to see happen faster.
Well, I'll follow.
Go ahead. Thank you, Madam Chair. So then I assume the transformation plans that the CCOs will be submitting will be related to these metrics?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, yes. We tried to make sure that the transformation plans were actually addressing these same kind of focus areas, so we're all rowing in the same direction.
Okay.
Yes.
Great. Thank you.
That's great. And would you be ready to report on the first round of metrics data by September or
Madam
more
Chair,
like December?
Again, for the metrics that we would have available in late summer, then hopefully September for those, and then the remainder would be at the beginning of 2014.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And posted publicly and available hopefully widely.
That's right.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you so much.
Thank
Did this
you.
Answer your questions?
It's a start. I would like a copy of the DOJ agreement if that would be possible. I've been wondering.
Can you give me my personal copy right now?
Okay. No, I had conversations with Attorney General Kroger a couple years ago, and they backed off, and I was kind of trying to read between the lines. And,
mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
This is where it lands.
Thank you so much. I know this was a lot of organization for you to do, but we really, really appreciate
it's
it.
It's you and me, Bruce.
Look,
it's okay.
You're making Sandy upset. All right. With that, I'll close the informational meeting, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 420. And I'm not sure who.
132.
No. 132.
I'm sorry, 132. What did I say?
120.
Yeah, 132.
My Lord.
Sandy, can you bring us up to date? And so Jay Rosenblum and Ann Stone first.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this bill is before the at the request of Children First for Oregon. It changes certain documentation that must be submitted to the school administrators for the purpose of opting out of immunizations. This has an emergency clause. And I believe we have some amendments, but I'm not sure which ones they're going to speak to.
All right. Well, I didn't get Ann Stone. I got Reagan Gray. Yes. So, yes.
So, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Reagan Gray, and I'm sitting in for Ann Stone, who is very sick today. Mm. And so I'll be providing her testimony. And I wanted to clarify, this bill was at the request of the Oregon Pediatric Society, not Children First, my other client. So I'm also here today representing Oregonians for Healthy Children. We're a coalition who is in support of this legislation, and the members range from school and child care providers, the medical community, and organizations representing both children and seniors. Under current law, the children who attend child care or school are required to submit a form verifying that they've received a vaccine, the required vaccines. That form is signed by their medical professional. Other children are not able to be vaccinated, and they have a form that is signed by their medical professional stating why they're not able to be vaccinated. The third type of form that can be turned in is from parents who say that they want to exempt out of the vaccine requirements. This form is only signed by a parent. What Senate Bill 132 does is it brings that non-medical exemption more in line with the other documentation requirements. And it requires parents who choose not to vaccinate their children, when they submit the form stating that they want to be exempt, also submitting proof that they've received some sort of education on what the risks are associated for their child and the community in not vaccinating. They can either receive that education and prove that they've received that education from either a signature from their doctor that says that doctor or a healthcare professional who says that they have explained those risks, or that they have gone online or in some other form received online or other educational material, and that will be provided by OHA. At the end of the completion of that, they will receive a certificate that says that they have understand those risks. We want to do this because most parents are seeking information online that is often inaccurate and incomplete. And this legislation will ensure that parents get credible, medically based information about immunizations and vaccine preventable diseases. The bill also changes or clarifies current language under why people are exempting out of these vaccines. Right now, vaccine requirements. Right now, parents are filing this under a religious exemption. That doesn't fully describe why families are doing this. Sometimes it's also personal beliefs. So we've changed the language from religious to non-medical exemption. This in no way limits a parent's ability to exempt or takes away any sort of religious freedom. We also brought forward the Dash 1 amendments, which I know this isn't a work session, but I will speak to those. It accomplishes two things, changes in the bill. First, it pushes the implementation date from January to March of 2014. The reason for that is the date that parents need to submit these forms is February, and to start the bill in January and require it to be turned in by February is too short of notice, so we pushed it out to March so that they have a full year for compliance. The other thing it does is changes the signatory requirement to the definition or to somebody who is a healthcare practitioner rather than a practitioner of the healing arts. We believe that this is someone who, within their professional education, can provide medically accurate information on immunizations. We think that this bill makes it a lot stronger. And thank you, and I welcome any questions.
Let's go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to come. My name is Jay Rosenblum. I'm a pediatrician in Lake Oswego. I practice full-time as a primary care doctor. I see patients. I got my training at OHSU. I received a PhD in molecular and cell biology there, as well as my medical degree. But when I talk to families about, or when I talk to doctors about giving kids vaccines, these are conversations that I have on a daily basis. I'm also a third generation Oregonian and feel that this is the way that we make change at places like this. I am on the Oregon Pediatric Society. I'm the immediate past chair of the Oregon Partnership to Immunize Children, which just merged with the adult immunization program. Now it's called Immunize Oregon. And really, one of the great things about immunizations is that they are a product of their own success. As we've gotten better at vaccinating, we have seen less and less disease. The parents that of the children I take care of now have never seen measles. They don't understand. It's not part of their consciousness. So the fact that 1 in 500 children who get the measles die, regardless of the medical care that they get, it is a horrible, deadly disease. The vaccines that we have are safe, they're effective, and they prevent the horrible things that I hope never to see in my career. There are two things about vaccinating children. One of them is protecting that individual child. But the other is, and I hate the term herd immunity, but it's something that references that when there's less disease in the community, you're less likely to infect those who either can't be vaccinated or if their immune system didn't respond. For example, I had a baby, a patient of mine, who died from whooping cough. She was too young to be vaccinated. So it wasn't a question of had she had her vaccine. It was that there was enough pertussis in the community. She caught whooping cough, and at 6 weeks old, she passed away. It's tragic. But that's when we talk about herd immunity, that's what we're talking about, is that if we allow vaccine rates to go low enough, we will see the vulnerable suffer, not necessarily. I mean, you know, maybe a healthy 10-year-old, you know, they get pertussis. Chances are they'll just cough for 2 or 3 months and be miserable. So it's not only to protect them, it's to protect those who it's our duty to protect, who can't protect themselves. I think that most parents understand the importance of immunizations. But the fact that Oregon has the highest rate of non-medical exemptions for kids starting kindergarten, it's the highest rate in the country, and it's more than doubled in the last decade. This isn't just a theoretical concern. Parents are trying to do the right thing by their children. They want to protect their children. And as Reagan said, people are going out and they're doing research to make sure that they are making the right choice. Now, where they get that research material, it can come from magazines, it can come from the internet, and I teach a course on vaccine controversies, and I'll show slides of quotes from, some of them are MDs even, talking about how vaccines cause all kinds of things, and there's such silly nonsense that's out there. We want to make sure that parents are making an informed consent, that whatever information that they have, it is from a person who is actually knowledgeable enough to answer their questions, or from the module that they can get online. I recently attended a lecture by a chiropractor in my area. It was called Sugar and Spice and Everything Nice, and then a hyphen, not what's in your vaccines. And I listened politely through his lecture and then asked him lots of questions. And honestly, what he had done is he had attended one lecture at one conference that he went to, asked the woman for the slides, and then he was talking, and almost everything that he said was not based in science. It had cherry-picked. You know, it's like, well, if you find one little piece that says, well, that this amount of aluminum is bad, well, but the FDA says that, you know, the FDA says these are fine. But they, well, no, the FDA. You know, it's one of those where I want parents to be making a good, informed decision. So it's our goal that parents who seriously want to exempt their child, if they truly believe that that's what's best, I'm not looking to take that right away from them. What I want them to do is make sure that they're using accurate information to get there. So it's my hope that with your assistance, we'll be able to change the rules. I wanted to correct one thing Reagan said, that when parents sign, they get this form that has all their kids' immunizations on it. The first way is parents fill in all the blanks of which vaccines their child has had, and the parent signs saying that that's true. It can be a parent or a medical provider who can sign that. However, in order to exempt your child from vaccines, you take that same form, you don't have to fill in any of the blanks, you flip it over and you sign at the bottom. So it's faster and easier to exempt your child from vaccines than it is to actually report which vaccines your child has had. And what we've seen around the country, states like Vermont and Washington, as they look at, if you make it so easy, that people sometimes will take the path of least resistance. Even though they care about their children, life is busy. So thank you, and I'll take your questions.
Questions, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Knope.
So I read the bill, and so is the goal to increase immunization through education, or is the goal to eliminate the religious exemption? Because the bill does both.
Well, it does not eliminate religious exemption. Somebody can be exempt for any reason that they want.
No, I understand that, but the bill actually takes out the religious exemption language in lines 17, 18, and 19. And I understand that you're expanding that for any reason, but it does that. So what's the goal? Is it both, or is it one or the other?
Well, if you look at why people exempt from vaccines, it is the tiniest fraction of people who actually belong to a religious community that the religion limits, that they don't recommend vaccines. And so it's actually right now what we're having people do is be a little bit dishonest, because they're signing a religious exemption now when it's not, in fact has nothing to do with their religion. So it wasn't that we were looking to eliminate the religious exemption. It's that if somebody wants to be exempt, they can be exempt. If they say it's because of their religion, that's fine. But it wasn't that we were looking to eliminate anything. It's that we were looking to clarify why are people exempting, and the language that we had it didn't do that. Now, the second half of your question, yes, it is our goal that we decrease the number of children who are exempted. We don't expect every child will be fully vaccinated. We do expect that there will be parents who will exempt their children. The study that was done in the state of Oregon asked families, how do you feel about vaccines? It was Jim Shames and Steve Robison, and they published this. They used the Oregon Vaccine Hesitancy Index, and what they found were that there were 2 or 3% of the population in the state of Oregon that are entrenched. They feel that vaccines are bad. No matter what we say, they're always going to feel that. There are about 15% of the people who were sitting on the fence. They were the ones trying to do their homework. They were trying to do the research. They were going online. They were asking their friends. And then there was a little over 80% that were accepting. They just said, hey, doc, that's what you do. That's what I pay you for. You do your homework and tell me what I should do. So it's really the 15%, the ones who want to do their homework, the ones who want correct information and aren't getting it, because where they're going for their information, they don't know where the credible information is. So by doing this, we're saying, this is what's credible. This is what the Centers for Disease Control, the World Health Organization, the American Academy of Pediatrics, those types of groups are saying, is this is what people should learn before they before they exempt their children from vaccines.
Dr. Steiner Hayward.
Did you have a follow-up, Senator Knope?
Sure, go ahead, though.
No, I mean,
if no, you want follow up if you have a follow up,
please.
Well, here's my concern, and I haven't seen the amendment, so I don't know.
They are.
I couldn't find it on mine. I tried.
That's okay. We just uploaded them again.
Okay.
I'll pull it up for you.
What do the amendments do?
I don't know.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Knope, the amendment does two things.
Which one?
The dash one amendment does two things. It under the definition of a person who can be a signatory for the non-medical exemption, it changes it from practitioner of the healing arts to healthcare practitioner. We believe that's somebody within their scope of education that they understand immunizations and can, you know, be able to describe it to parents. And it also it pushes the implementation date to March rather than January because we have the school exclusion day that's in February.
Okay. I would love to be able to vote for this bill. As it's written, I can't vote for it because you are removing the religious exemption. And Oregon has a long history of religious freedom. As a matter of fact, Article 1, Section 3 of the Oregon Constitution reads that no law shall in any case, whatever, control the free exercise, enjoyment of religion, opinions or dictates of their own conscience. So opinions or interfere with the rights of their of conscience. So if you leave that in and go, you know, if you leave that exemption in and you say that then there's another alternative, you know, that's something that I can support. And I would love to be able to do that. I just wanted to make that clear for the chair and
thank
for other
you,
committee members,
Senator.
And you know.
All right, Senator Steiner Hubbard. Perhaps I could say two things, and I appreciate Senator Knoop your concern about this. In general, I'd like to see an opinion from legislative counsel or an appropriate legal authority about whether the bill, as it's currently written, would in fact remove the religious exception. But from my perspective, the reason to keep the language this way is because we start to get into too much list making in statute, you know, religious exemption, philosophical exemption, whatever, whatever, whatever. That being said, if this is really a major concern, I wonder how you all would feel about an additional amendment that would say, including but not limited to religious, philosophical, and adding a place on the form where the parent could list why they're requesting, because I think that would be useful data for us to collect. So that we really do understand what percentage of people are exempting truly for religious reasons or others. I'd like to see more data on this. I'd like to really understand and be able to parse down why people are not are choosing to exempt their children from immunization. So I guess the first thing I would say is I'd like to see a legal opinion. And second, if the legal opinion says there's some gray area here and it might, in fact, as Senator Knoop suggests, remove the religious exemption, is there a way to change the language slightly to say, list a couple of the reasons, but use that famous including but not limited to, so that we don't have to list out every possible reason, and add a place where it says the parents have to write down why they're choosing to exempt, just so we can get some information and start to explain it a little
bit. I think just to let everyone know that probably will need to be some amendments to this. And I want everyone who's doing amendments to work through the committee chair so that we don't have three different silos working on amendments trying to accomplish the same thing. And she'll be the coordinator.
You want them to work through the committee administrator, not the chair.
I'm sorry, not me. The committee administrator.
I didn't mean to say that we should do it in a different way. I'm just saying here's a proposal that might meet Senator Knoop's concerns, and but also not force parents to lie, essentially, and claim adherence to religion that forbids immunization when, in fact, it's because they believe that the potential harms of immunization outweigh the potential benefits.
So, Chair Mona Sanders and fellow committee members, other states have actually tried that. Allowing for religious exemption. And then the question was, how do you make it so that it's truly, so that it's people who it is religious? So there are some states that have the clergy of that person's clergy signs off. We actually looked, and I talked to clergy members from around the state and even sent some emails. I ended up talking to the Archdiocese of Florida. They actually wrote an opinion saying that no child in any Catholic school would be allowed to have a religious exemption because it runs counter to the teachings of the church. Even with all of the, there are some questions about where did the cells come from that are used to grow the vaccines. They said it is absolutely the state archdiocese. So where do we, how do we define religion? So up till now, we've defined it as a series of beliefs, and that's left us to where we are now, and that's that anybody can say anything is their religion. And so as much as I understand your point, and I respect that, I don't want to limit anybody's religious freedom. But if we leave it too broad, then we end up going back to having measles epidemics.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, we absolutely will work with you on this kind of issue, because I really want to address Senator Knope's concerns and make sure that, because we know that the bill, the way it's drafted right now, does not limit religious exemptions, and we will make sure whatever we need to do to kind of clarify that, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank you very much and stay in the, just in case we need you, but I'd like to call up Dr. Pat Luckey and Lorraine Duncan.
Senator Monis Anderson, members of the committee, I'm sorry I didn't sign up. I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. And I just wanted to introduce Dr. Ludke. He's our public health officer. First time in Salem, comes to Lane County from the state of Utah, and very experienced in the issue of immunizations. The Lane County Board of Commissioners has taken a position on this bill already. It was one of our priorities leading up to the session, and we would love to see a work session on the bill and have it passed. Anything we can do to help, we'd offer.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I want to speak briefly about basically what keeps me awake at night as a public health officer.
Introduce yourself.
Oh, yes, thank you. I had thought that Alex did that for me. Mm. Dr. Patrick Lebke, Lane County Public Health Officer in Eugene, Oregon. I want to speak briefly about what it is that keeps public health officers up at night. Dr. Rosenblum spoke briefly about that. I'm going to talk about a little regional data that we have from what's happening on the West Coast recently and why I think it's impactful to this bill and what it means to us going forward. So many of you who probably read the newspaper and saw the joys last year in the state to the north of us with their whooping cough outbreak were probably surprised by what happened. They had the largest whooping cough outbreak they'd seen in 50 years in that state, historical by U.S. standards from back in the 1940s, hadn't been surpassed. They went up 617% from just a few hundred scattered cases to well over 5,000 cases last year in Washington State. And as a result, their state health officer declared a whooping cough pandemic in April of that year and released a variety of public health measures to try to control that massive epidemic. This whooping cough epidemic affected not only individuals because of the healthcare issue, it affected varieties of groups of people. So schools were closed, mass gatherings were changed, the way healthcare was delivered in a variety of clinical and hospital settings was changed because staff and patients had to be addressed around respiratory issues. This was a significant problem. And from years and years of public health research and clinical experience and practice, we know that whooping cough is an extraordinarily infectious agent. Whereas influenza, a single case of flu, might cause two or three other cases, whooping cough will cause 15, 16, 17 other cases from a single case. So the response to it needs to be really abrupt, needs to be massive, needs to be overwhelming to prevent an even worse outbreak in case types of actions were not put into place. Some of those measures that I mentioned, they included closing daycares, closing schools, altering the way that care was delivered in a variety of situations. There were effects on business. There were a variety of effects. Now, what's interesting is that many persons outside of public health were surprised by what happened in Washington State. But people in public health were not surprised, because at the time, Washington State had the worst vaccination rate in the country, 2010, 2011. People in public health knew it was coming. There was a big conversation around what would happen when it came. Unfortunately, it did hit them. Public health was also not surprised, because in 2010, California had its worst whooping cough outbreak since the 1940s. They had 10,000 cases. Over 1,000 kids were hospitalized. They had 10 babies die. A big issue in California. So the disease was lurking nearby. The immunization rates were the worst in the country in Washington. It was just a matter of time before it had happened. And in fact, it did happen. So putting those pieces together, I think it's important to take a good look at where is Oregon today. So as Dr. Rosenblum mentioned, we now have the wonderful distinction of having the worst kindergarten immunization rate in the country, which is most unfortunate. We also know diseases lurking nearby on the West Coast. We're sandwiched between two states that had the worst outbreaks in 50 years. I think it's a matter of time. It's going to hit us. Maybe this summer. This is a respiratory disease for whatever reason. It's one of the rare respiratory diseases that tends to peak in the summer months. Most of them peak in the winter months. We may have a really nasty summer. So I think that if you put those pieces together, you get a sense of the falling vaccination rates. Try to understand why they have been falling. There's been a lot of research around why vaccination rates have been falling. And it's not just in the United States. A good deal of the Western world has seen a variety of falls in vaccination rates for all sorts of vaccine-preventable conditions. And most of that research, if you were to summate it and put it together, there's roughly seven issues about why it is that the rates are falling. And what's most interesting is that none of those seven include access to health care. None of those seven include probably some prominent issues that you would wonder why, in fact, they don't include it, like rural versus urban versus frontier. But those are not the issues of why vaccination rates are falling. These are personal decisions. These are not decisions based upon access to health care, financial concerns. In fact, every year we throw away more vaccines than probably most people realize. And it's most unfortunate that we do, in fact, do that. They're simply not being utilized. So if we look nationally again, I think there are several effective policy-based reasons why Senate Bill 132 should move forward. And this bill is, in fact, patterned on a very successful example that happened in Washington State, unfortunately too late for them to avert the big epidemic they had a year ago. They implemented a very similar bill as this. They had a 25% increase in immunization across their kindergarten ages. We would expect something fairly similar to that here in Oregon. That would bump us, we believe, to a high enough level where we would have community immunity or herd immunity, as Dr. Rosenblum was speaking of. Finally, I just want to mention briefly that I'm the chair of the Health Officer Caucus here in our state. We have 34 local health departments. We meet once a month. I surveyed all the health officers here before coming to testify today, and we're a diverse group. We have rural, urban, and frontier. We have a variety of political, financial concerns. I have to say, we agree on very little most of the time. We rarely come to consensus, but we come to a general agreement to move things forward. But on this bill, it's different. Every single person, every respondent supports this bill. And that's independent of whether they're from Multnomah, Clackamas, big counties. I'm learning the counties in my new state here. Jackson or Lane County, mid-sized counties, Tillamook and Wasco that are small counties. Every one of those health officers supports this bill going forward and thinks it's the right thing to do. So I, too, think it's the right bill at the right time, and I'd be happy to answer your questions, discuss this further.
Let's have Lorraine and then
Chair Monis Anderson and committee members, my name is Lorraine Duncan. I'm the Immunization Program Manager for the State of Oregon for the Public Health Division, the Oregon Health Authority. The Public Health Division is neutral on this bill, but I understood that you had some questions, mm-hmm. and I wrote out the answers to the questions, and I'd like to go through them quickly for you.
Yes, please do.
So the first question was, what is the current rate and the trend on non-medical exemptions? So on the last page of the handout that you have in front of you, there's a chart that shows that in 2001, we were just under 2% non-medical exemptions, and in 2012, we're at 5.8. So it's gone up drastically. It goes up each year. You can just see it stair-stepping up. The other thing that you don't often understand is that when you look at non-medical exemptions across the state, it's 5.8% for kindergartners, but it's drastically different by county. So if you look at the map on the back of your chart, that it's the ones that are really dark, like the southern Oregon counties like Coos at 8%, Curry at 12%, Josephine at 10%, Lane at 8.5%. And then there's a lot of more medium counties like Multnomah County at 7.6, and then some counties really low, like 1% or 2%. And even in counties like Jackson County that only have a 6.3, they have clusters like Ashland with really high rates, and then the rest of the county is low, but the particular city is high. So we collect this data by high school catchment area. So if there's particular ones that you want to have additional information for, we'd be
happy. Well, I found it interesting that you said some Oregon schools have a very high exemption rates, up to 70%.
Right, like in Ashland and Josephine County, that's very true.
You also stated a school needs a 94% immunization rate to keep the measles virus from spreading.
Right. So, Senator Chair Monis Anderson, it's really important that for herd immunity, like Dr. Rosenblum was talking about, that we maintain high immunization levels. It's, the threshold is different by antigen. So like for measles and pertussis, it's 94% immunization levels. For others, it's a lower.
Thank you. Senator Cano.
Question, Madam Chair. So it looks like the best performing counties are rural counties, but one of the worst performing counties is also a rural county. Curry at 12%, Mall here at 0.9%. But have we learned anything, or can we learn anything from, say, Jefferson County at 1% and Malheur County at 0.9% versus a Curry County at 12% or Multnomah at 7.6 or Deschutes at 7.7? Have we discovered anything? I mean, parents are parents kind of all across the state. So what is it about those counties that leads them to be better performing than the rest?
Chairman Sanderson and Senator Knope, lots of times we find in particular schools that there's an advocate for immunizations or an advocate for taking non-medical exemptions. So how the exemptions or how the immunization process is explained leads people in one direction or the other. I think that has a lot of effect on it.
Can I have a comment?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, as a family physician and somebody who's been active statewide, I've thought about this issue a fair amount. I think that part of it may also relate to the kinds of relationships that people have with their primary care providers and the fact that in rural communities, smaller rural communities, often the healthcare providers are some of the thought leaders in the community. And if they do a good job of getting out, even outside of the office, and explaining to their community about the importance of going to PTA meetings or things like that, which you often see physicians doing in rural communities, then that changes the conversation as well. So not only can there be parent advocates, but I think that there are healthcare advocates, healthcare provider advocates for this as well. And in a small community, I mean, I've worked in John Day, and I can tell you that out there, the doctors, the nurse practitioners, the people at the hospital, they're pretty darn important to those communities, and when they talk about something, they're considered highly credible sources of information. And it doesn't mean that people in urban communities don't have strong connections to their primary care providers, but there are a lot more sources of information. There are a lot more other people who are considered authoritative or credible, and so that changes the conversation a little bit. So I think personally, as a primary care physician, that's one of the reasons I think there's a difference.
Go ahead with answering the questions that you have. We have one more that we asked you.
Yeah. So the second question you asked about was in regard to the educational module and what would it look like? So I think many of you were here when we passed the vaccine stewardship legislation in 2011 that required an educational module. So the immunization program has got some experience in doing educational modules, and there's a link on this handout that shows you where to go, and you can look at the ones that we currently have available and that we've done. We're open to suggestions. Obviously, this one is a totally different topic, but they'd have the same sort of look and feel. And the idea would be that we'd start out by frequently asked questions that we normally get, that physicians normally get, and explain the most current evidence in regard to those. And then for the rest of the non-medical exemptions, a parent can choose one or several or all to be exempt for. So we would have information about each one of the requirements. For example, measles, mumps, and rubella. So they'd have to do another 2 minutes on the internet module about measles, mumps, and rubella. And if they wanted another exemption, there'd be a couple more. Then the certificate would print out, and it would show which ones they have exemptions for, because they've taken that additional thing. It would be interactive. There'd be some questions. We'd probably do it in several languages. They would be at seventh grade reading level. So we're hoping that people will take a look at the ones that we've done, and we're certainly open to suggestions. We're also going to be working closely with parents who have their child fully immunized and parents who don't have their children fully immunized, to look at the suggestions that we have for the module and to come up with ideas about things that they think we should do.
And you have to be computer literate for this, so will there be pamphlets for something to...
Chair Monis Anderson, definitely. There'll be alternate formats, so we could do pamphlets, we could do a number of different things. So, you know, some people don't have computers. They'd have to go to the library. Some would have to use them in the schools. And then there just have to be written material because some people don't use the internet.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Yes. And the last question that you had was in regard to the -1 amendments that the Oregon Pediatric Society has done. They changed the definition in that amendment to be healthcare practitioner, and the committee asked where that is defined. So that's currently defined by Oregon Administrative Rule, and it is used for when a provider signs for immunization. Most of the time, that isn't done by a provider. Most of the time, it's done by a parent. But a provider can sign that. Or if they're documenting immunity, like a titer, or the person's had a communicable disease, so they would do that. So this is an administrative rule.
So our naturopaths, nurse practitioners, chiropractors, I mean, who's on that list?
So the current definition reads...
Is it on the back?
It's on the bottom of the second page. Healthcare practitioner means a practitioner of the healing arts who has...
Oh, gotcha.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so the idea would be, if the legislation passed, that we'll look at this definition and see if it's still appropriate or whether we'd add additional ones, because it would be covering this new element.
We are adding... we have a bill that would take the pharmacists would be able to give immunizations, and I'm not sure which kind of provider with pharmacy, to down at least to age 3. Is that, are they?
So, Madam Chair, pharmacists aren't currently in this definition, so that's one of the things that we'd want to look at, whether when we do new administrative rules. I don't think pharmacists would want to do it because it's not a reimbursable issue, and so I doubt that they would.
Gotcha. All right. Any other questions? Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you said you could get us information on immunization rates by catchment area? By cluster for each
Chair
high school?
Chair Monis Anderson and Senator Shields, definitely, yes.
Could you get that to me for the Jefferson cluster and the Roosevelt cluster in Portland Public
yes,
Schools?
Definitely.
And Madam Chair, follow-up. And I assume that includes non-public schools as well, Catholic schools, parochial schools. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Great. Yes.
Senator Morris Anderson, my understanding of the bill that you mentioned about pharmacists was during an emergency only.
Outbreak.
Yeah. So I just wanted
to... whooping cough. That's what I was thinking of.
But it wouldn't really be an issue if we're just talking about people who are trying to let people...
Senator Steiner, they would need to...
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I'm not sure that it's going to be relevant because that's a situation where parents are actively seeking immunizations as opposed to choosing to exempt their children. So I'm not... sure that for this particular purpose we'd need to expand the definition. And I guess the question I would ask Ms. Duncan is, if we have one uniform definition of healthcare provider, is it going to be a problem because it may be that we want to include certain providers? Are we going to have to end up with multiple definitions? Would be my concern, because it might be one set people for this particular purpose, but another set for other purposes? Is there any concern, either with the immunization team, or I don't know if anybody from the health authority is still here, but...
Well, Lorraine is.
Well, I mean, that not just the health, I don't need to go from the health authority, but I mean, like, more general, who deal with healthcare providers and other times when their definitions are used. So you understand my question? I'm sorry, I'm being a little bit vague.
Chair Monis Anderson and Senator Steiner Hayward, yes. I understand your question, and that is a possibility, but in the -1 amendments that the Oregon Pediatric Society has done, and I understand there might be additional amendments, we think that the definition for healthcare practitioner will fit in the different places that we need to use them.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. We only have about 13 minutes left, and so I'd like to call Vern Sabo, who wants to address the -3 amendments, Jean Donovan, and Katie Zuckerman. And as they're coming up, I want to, since it doesn't seem like we have anyone against the bill,
coming, I did get a couple, two emails, one from Peter Lund, and he was very much opposed to removing the religious exemption. This isn't a good idea, and I will submit that for to be put in OLS. And then another one from Jody McCaffrey, please say no to Senate Bill 132. The current one-size-fits-all vaccination program is actually harming our kids. And again, I will submit that to the administrator put online.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, Dr. Vern Sable representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. I'll make my comments brief. Basically, the Dash 3 amendments, what we want to ensure is that chiropractic physicians qualify under statute for those healthcare providers that can provide the evidence-based information to our patients, to parents, so they can make an informed choice. I have board-certified chiropractic internists and colleagues who are board-certified in pediatrics, and that's their specialty, and that we're assured that we are a healthcare provider that can provide that information, and if that parent decides to exempt out of immunizations, they can do so with us, but we can provide them the evidence-based information, provide that service to them. That's the crux of my testimony.
And again, I guess, Lorraine, if you heard his comments regarding making sure that the chiropractors are a part of it, I don't know. You have a rulemaking process, and I'd like to make sure that your concern is addressed through the committee administrator and working with the health authority.
Okay. Madam Chair, Monis Anderson and members of the committee, my name's Jean Donovan. I'm a nurse, and I've been a nurse for 30 years. I'm a member of Oregon Nurse Association Cabinet on Health Policy, and I'm testifying on behalf of ONA today. And I'm speaking in favor of Senate Bill 132. I believe it's a reasonable measure to ensure parents are well informed before choosing not to vaccinate. And I'm submitting my written testimony, but I just wanted to share a personal experience with immunizations myself. 26 years ago, my infant son, precious newborn, was time for his immunizations, and I took him to the health department. And I was a very concerned mother, well-informed, I thought, and I told the public health nurse, I'll do the other immunizations, but not MMR, because I was afraid. I'd read material that linked it at that time to mental retardation, and I thought, that's a higher risk than, I had measles, so it's not that big a deal if he gets measles, so I would rather not err on the side of giving him the possibility of becoming mentally retarded. So, because I was worried, I chose to opt out of giving his immunization. The public health nurse very calmly and wisely said, do you understand the facts? And I said, I think I do. And so she just promptly, gently, but very clearly explained to me the risks and benefits of the MMR vaccine. And it was information that I didn't know. It was very non-threatening. And so as a result, I changed my mind right then and there. And I said, I realize now he's at greater risk of getting measles and suffering some serious consequences than of getting becoming mentally retarded, which is actually, research showed there was no clear linkage. It was just based on popular literature. Even being a nurse, because of my love for my son and my fear, the perceived risk was outweighed my judgment. So based on new information, I went ahead and had him vaccinated. He did not become mentally retarded, but he had other problems, but anyway. So my own experience, I think, suggests two points, that well-intentioned, intelligent parents, loving parents, can be misinformed through, and especially I think this is more true today than it was 26 years ago with the internet proliferation of information from a variety of sources. And secondly, that respectful, straightforward presentation of reliable information can help parents make more informed decisions whether to pursue vaccination or not, but that given the facts enables them to be more make wiser choices. So thank you for this opportunity.
Well, thank you, and thank you for testifying. Appreciate it. All right.
Now,
Kathy left.
Kathy left, so all we have is Tanvi Hathawala. And was there anyone else? Our last one.
Madam Chair, while she's coming up, I just wanted to let you know that I had 32 emails in opposition to the bill, and all of them were religious exemption.
Were they?
So
I got clearly, one of them. So
clearly there's a group that's concerned about that, yeah. And that's why I bring that to everybody's attention, because I think we're here to protect the rights of a minority.
That's right.
Majority. Hello, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tanvi Hathawala. I'm a pediatric resident at OHSU's Dornbecker's Children's Hospital. And I'm submitting my testimony supporting Senate Bill 132. In my clinic, I've often come across patients who refuse vaccinations. And I spend a lot of our very precious time trying to understand the reasons behind why these families are refusing vaccinations to better help them understand the pros and cons of getting vaccines. I'm often struck by the vast amount of misinformation that families receive about vaccines. I've had families tell me that eating organic fruits and vegetables will provide them with the same amount of immunity to measles, mumps, and rubella as getting an MMR vaccine. I've had other families refuse vaccines out of concerns for their children potentially developing autism or having mercury poisoning. And yet others who have refused to receive vaccines out of concerns that if we give them a vaccine, it will give them the disease that we are actually trying to prevent. All of these claims are entirely unfounded and are basically based on, as the nurse had mentioned previously, on the vast amount of misinformation that is out there on the internet and in other sources that parents turn to when they have questions. In January of 2013, so just last month, I was rotating with the Infectious Disease Service at Dornbecker Children's Hospital, and I saw a child there with full-blown measles. Many pediatricians, if they're lucky, you know, from a clinical standpoint, will see measles maybe one time in their entire career. And we had a case of full-blown measles come in my first year of residency. Shortly after that, two other unvaccinated children in Marion County went on to develop measles as well. It turned out that these children were not vaccinated for measles due to the fact that their mother believed that receiving vaccinations may lead to insulin-dependent diabetes mellitus or type 1 diabetes. This is an entirely false belief, and the fact that she had refused the vaccination caused her child to later on go and develop measles. So these experiences only serve to show the great need for improved education prior to vaccine refusal. I have found in my own personal experience that with adequate teaching, with patient teaching, with sort of trying to understand why people are refusing vaccines, and providing appropriate resources that are easy for parents to understand, I have actually been able to convince some patients' parents to allow their children to receive vaccinations, and in doing so, hopefully prevent some of those vaccine-preventable diseases. Other patients and their parents have declined vaccinations, but at the very least, I feel as though they've made an informed decision after receiving appropriate information. So I believe that passing Senate Bill 132 would allow for appropriate education and informed decision-making with regards to vaccinations by providing information to families that we know is valid from the CDC and from the WHO, and would then allow parents to make informed decision-making. So thank you so much for allowing me to contribute my perspective. Any questions?
Yes, thank you. All right,
thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, I'd like the Oregon Pediatric Society to actually work through the committee administrator on some of the issues that came forward, and we want to make sure that we communicate with the Oregon Health Authority, the immunization department, to make sure that, you know, we're not going against whatever rule making, et cetera, that they have. So with that, no further comment. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 132, and we are adjourned.